Every now and so often, I like to go to the St. Mark's Bookshop in the East Village and bingle through their items for sale on consignment. Sometimes I find some real gems. A few colognes ago, I found a really funny, well-put-together zine there called The Life and Times of Sheldon Grubbs. It was full of witty stories and interestingly juxtaposed clip art. This was a few years ago, but I found one recently and thought it would be a great idea to have Sheldon Grubbs pay a visit to the Ed Shep radio experiment. But there was a problem. What could be the theme? I pondered over this for some bites of a Snickers bar with almonds, and then realized that no theme was necessary. I could just present an audio version of The Life and Times of Sheldon Grubbs. So that's what I did. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you
After the Jump,
The Life and Times of Sheldon Grubbs.
After the Jump.
Sheldon Grubbs failed the third grade. I flunked. Now, I know I'm not the brightest star in the universe, a fading glow stick at best, but how the hell do you fail the third grade? That's like failing your driver's test before you even get a chance to put on your seatbelt. I should know. Okay, so I can understand the eighth grade. It's a pivotal grade. And it's a stretch, but I can also see failing the fifth and sixth grade. Maybe. But the third grade? You have to be a submoronic to fail the third grade. I think it's worth mentioning that Jerry Lewis also failed the third grade, so I'm in pretty good company. I think my school, St. Mel's, must have had some sort of quota to fill that year, because two other kids from my class, Bob Puzo and Susie Van Horn, also failed. Bob was that kid in class who liked to stick things up his nose. Just about anything you put in front of him went up his nose. Marbles, sandwiches, traffic cones, you name it. One time he sneezed in class and out came a rabbit's foot, followed by his report card and two servings of mashed potatoes. I don't remember anything about Susie, except that she looked like an anglerfish and smelled like fried bologna. Also, she had red hair and sucked on her thumb well into high school. She was my first crush, and I spent tortured nights dreaming of her. But that's not saying much, since I also spent many tortured nights dreaming of the shark in Jaws. When it came time to break the news to me, they were very diplomatic about it, and shied away from the words failed and flunked. Instead, they told me that I was being held behind, as if I was standing at a busy intersection, and I was being held back by some matronly crossing guard who was trying to protect me. Many years later, at the tail end of a drunken conversation with my mom, it was revealed that I was forced to repeat the third grade, not because I was so much stupider than the rest of my class, but because I was so much smaller than the rest of my class. I still don't believe this explanation, but the general consensus was that I would somehow benefit from being held behind. You know, so I could be around people my own size, the little people. Now, I might not be very smart, but I know one thing for sure. Repeating the third grade did not help. In fact, I say that the opposite was true. And convinced of my own stupidity, I didn't read another book for about 50 years, when I finally made it to the ninth grade and rediscovered Jim Morrison and the Doors. Okay, so that's just a little bit embarrassing. But the thing that impressed me about Mr. Morrison, besides the fact that he was a complete jerk, was that he was an avid reader. And I started to read everything that he read as a young malcontent. Nietzsche, O. Henry, Socrates, etc. Of course, I understood very little of what I was reading, but wherever I went, especially if I didn't want to talk to anyone, which was usually the case, I always had my nose in a book. Anyway, the news of my failure traveled fast, and before you knew it, I'd become a sort of celebrity with my friends and family. A minor celebrity, like a circus freak, or Frank Stallone. In other words, I was special. My friends ignored me, and soon they were my old friends. But that was nothing compared to the family functions I was forced to endure, where my aunts would point and whisper,
"Is that him? He looks a little, you know, off. Shh, shh, not so loud. I hear he steals hubcaps. Where's my purse? Has anyone seen my purse? So sad. Sad nothing. He'll probably end up on death row."
I was 8 years old. I failed one grade and already they had me on death row.
"I'm telling you, he's bad. Quiet, here he comes. Don't look, just smile. I'm scared."
That's a pretty accurate account of what most of my family functions were like. I'd been sprayed with the pungent musk of failure, and it smelled so bad that no one would come near me. It was a warning to all who came near to either back off or risk sharing my terrible fate. I could be sitting in a crowded room, engulfed in flames, and no one would even come close enough to spit on me. Except maybe my grandmother, who had a glandular problem, and was always spitting anyways. In conclusion, I'd like to make my peace and say that I don't blame anyone for having to repeat the third grade, except maybe my teacher and my parents. But it's so absurd to fail someone because of their size. That's like sizeism or something.
Every time some third-rate, low-budget director does a nightmare sequence, the first thing they call for is an ominous dwarf. Well, cinema is a superficial medium.
I lost my virginity to a lactose-intolerant albino named Ginger. She was 17, Catholic, and experienced. I, on the other hand, was 14. I was 14 and nothing more. The high school we attended was often referred to as progressive, which meant that art classes were mandatory and you could smoke in the parking lot. We met in painting class, and our teacher's name was Ted, whose wardrobe consisted of three choice items: Hawaiian shirts, cowboy boots, and spandex biker shorts. My parents, who never missed a parents-teacher conference in their lives, referred to him as eccentric, which was their polite way of saying, "He's gay." Ginger was the person in school that didn't play an instrument but could always be found in the music room, hanging out with the marching band and the marching band wannabes, where she was the low rung on the totem pole. She was, as far as I could tell, one of the most hated people in school, which seemed to be a point of pride for her, something to brag about, which she did constantly. To make matters worse, she was a straight-A student with perfect attendance, wore a leather jacket, and had a bowl cut like Joey Ramone. She was a punk rock nerd who liked to inject long, incomprehensible quotes by Heidegger and Shakespeare and Crass into every conversation, which might be why people rarely spoke to her, and when they did, it was almost always an insult. But Ginger's academic achievements were made all the more impressive by the fact that she was a raging alcoholic. She came to school drunk, kept a flask in her locker, and had no less than 3 fake IDs. Yet she still managed to get all A's, while I, completely sober, struggled for every one of my C's, D's, and F's. One day in class, I went up to her and complimented her on her painting, which was a large square canvas, completely red except for the hammer and the sickle in the center of the canvas, which was rainbow-colored. So we got to talking, and by the end of the class, she was offering me her services as a tutor. I gladly accepted. Then a few weeks later, she asked me if I would go to the fall dance with her. She referred to it as stupid and claimed that her mom was forcing her to go and that I'd be doing her a huge favor. I didn't know what to say. I stammered a few unintelligible words. I was terrified, yet flattered. It's true, I was attracted to her tenacity, if nothing else. But part of me was embarrassed, afraid to be seen with her. But I was new to the school, had no friends and few prospects. So reluctantly, I said yes. Ginger thanked me, gave me a bone-crushing hug, and quoted Nietzsche. Or maybe it was Jim Morrison, I'm not sure. On the night of the dance, we sat in her car and drank vodka from a plastic bottle. It burned, but I managed to choke it down. Then she offered me a joint, but I politely declined, noting that I don't smoke any major hallucinogenics, which was a quote from Annie Hall, my one and only quote. The rest, as they say, is history. After graduation, Ginger moved to Hoboken, New Jersey, where, thanks to a full academic scholarship, she was to study electrical engineering at SIT. But we promised to keep in touch, and she started sending me letters almost as soon as she got there. Stacks and stacks of letters, some of them more than 20 pages long. She wrote in great detail about her classes, all the bands she'd been seeing, how glad she was to get away from Minneapolis, and when was I coming to visit her. And then, several months later, there was a letter telling me how hard school was, and that she was falling behind. But she knew that if she buckled down, she'd pull through. This was followed by a letter that described how she'd fallen in with a crowd of hard-drinking, drug-abusing skinheads. So now was she not only a lactose-intolerant albino, but a lactose-intolerant albino skinhead. I guess you can't get any whiter than that. Anyway, things went from bad to worse, including the death of not one but two domesticated animals and the loss of her scholarship. By the end of the letter, she'd been forced to move back to Minneapolis to live with her mother, who was a recovering alcoholic 2 years sober. But I never saw her again, because while she was in Jersey, my family moved to California, where our correspondence continued, briefly, before we lost contact. In her last letter, right before we lost touch, she claimed that she was sober and that she was going back to school to study literature. She was going to follow her heart this time, and hopefully someday she would be a writer. I never wrote back.
See the Rumble.
I've pretty much been to the other big three, Mania, Survivor Series, SummerSlam, and I figured, you know, who knows when the Rumble's coming to New York again.
You went down to see the Rumble, and what did you think?
Everyone was really into it. The place looked like it was sold out. Everyone was cheering for the fan favorites, booing the heels. It was your standard wrestling crowd. Norman Smiley arrived at the arena, and I had my fingers crossed that he was going to be one of the surprise entrants.
Norman Smiley is a great, great man, as Brian Alvarez would be apt to say. I love the first person you said who greeted him. The wrestler came up and gave him a big hug. Norman actually had a run in Mexico, I believe, for a little while there as like a Black Magic or something was his name.
By the time I was born, my grandfather, Charlie, was losing it. So, on top of being a bit shell-shocked, he was also diagnosed with dementia. He took to wearing a Mexican wrestling mask. It was red with shiny gold trim, like shiny flames around the eyes and mouth, just like his boyhood idol, Crusher Rodriguez. My grandmother begged him to take it off, but he refused and wore the mask everywhere. To restaurants, the movies, and even church, where he was an usher. And kids in the neighborhood started asking him for his autograph, and he gladly obliged. During one of our visits, my grandfather, who insisted that we call him Crusher, attacked the sofa cushion. He put the cushion in a chokehold and started wrestling it in the middle of the living room. There was a great struggle. Furniture was destroyed, including my grandmother's plates commemorating the 51 states of America. But when the smoke cleared, Crusher was victorious. And then, like a true champion, he raised his arms in the air and spat on his arch rival, the sofa cushion. About a year later, he drop-kicked the Thanksgiving turkey. It bounced off the wall like a basketball and hit my cousin Joyce in the head. I choked on a mouthful of mashed potatoes as I burst into laughter while my grandmother, who stood off in the corner, cried. The next time I saw Crusher, he was living in a home. His spirit seemed to have left him, but the wrestling mask remained. In fact, it wasn't until his funeral, 5 years later, that I finally saw his face. I promised myself I wouldn't cry, and I didn't. Actually, I was kind of relieved. We probably all were. So, I said, "Take it easy, champ," and left the building. Later that evening, there was a party at the bowling alley, where Charlie used to drink.
Welcome to the Ed Shep Radio Experiment. My guest is Sheldon Grubbs. Why don't you tell us a little about yourself?
Well, Ed, my name's Sheldon, as you know, and I am from Chicago, Illinois. Blue Island, Illinois, to be exact. And I live in the Borough Park section of Brooklyn. And thank you for having me on the show. As you know, I write a little personal zine, also known as a purzine in the business. Entitled The Life and Times of Sheldon Grubbs. I've been doing it for a few years now. Currently working on number 11, which is loosely the theme is about travel and basically chronicle my travels in Europe and the United States, although I haven't traveled too much. That's about the gist of it. And I believe you saw my zine at St. Mark's Bookstore, is that correct?
I think I saw like the first one, and I saw it periodically thereafter.
Yeah, I try to put them on as often as possible. The first four I did in about 6 months. After that, I'm lucky to get out one a year. This last one I've been working on for about a year and a half, which is no indication of the quality, but I hope to get it out soon.
Take us through the process of creating one of the zines.
It's a lot of sitting around and procrastinating, and which is fun for me. A lot of Pong. I play a lot of Pong. That helps. I eat a lot of chips. Chips are good. And this helps the writing process. And then, depending on whether I have a typewriter that week or a computer, I write it down by hand a lot of times. Actually, the collage is... This is the first time I'm reading it with an audience that is not seeing the actual tangible zine in their hand, and there's a lot of collage and visual aid that helps the stories along, which it was fun to read them to an audience not seeing the actual zine.
Where are they distributed?
Besides St. Mark's Books, which is a really great place to sell zines, Margarita, who works at St. Mark's Books, is really great at keeping an eye and keeping track of the zines there. But also online at certain zine distros, which seem to come and go every other day. But there's a few out there, like Sweet Candy Distro and Parcel Press, run by this kid in, I believe, Virginia. Really great. His name's Taylor Ball. And they sell probably the bulk of the zines. If you're interested in finding zines, those are two places, sweetcandy.com and parcelpress.com. Very reliable sources through those outlets, and also I give them away periodically.
So anyone who wants your zine can go to the websites or whatever?
Yeah, or they can write to me at Sheldon_Grubbs@hotmail.com, and I will send them one, and probably a bunch of other stuff. Whatever I could fit in an envelope, I will probably send.
Do they have to send you a check for $2?
They can send me whatever they want. I accept pictures of their mom, recipes, newspaper clippings, mixtapes are always welcome. Whatever they want to send, I will try to compensate them with equal or greater value in zine. Even if it's not my zine, I will send them someone's zine that I have in my vast collection of zines that are taking up space in my room that I would be more than willing to send on to somebody else.
So what else do you do besides the zine?
Well, Well, I'm also currently... good thing you asked. In a band called The Shades. That's S-H-A-Y-D-E-S. Shades. When a lot of people hear that name, they also often think of sunglasses. But actually, it's lampshades. We wear lampshades on our heads, and we play fun music. And we hope to be playing a few shows coming up in April. I wish I can give you more information, but also I do that. And... What else? I also make Super 8 movies, which I actually haven't done that in a while, but I hope to be getting back into that again. Balloon folding is another favorite hobby of mine, origami, which is basically balloon folding, but with paper. Sleeping is a good thing. I like that. I like to read, but mostly it's just the zines and drinking coffee and hanging out with my cats, Francis and Noodle, and that's the gist. Mostly writing, doing a lot of writing, a lot of traveling, writing. No, that's a lie. Not a lot of traveling. Also, I will be having a radio show on WBAR, Barnard College Radio, this summer, and I don't know what it's going to be called yet, and I don't know what the format is yet, but whatever it is, it's going to be good, and I hope maybe you come on, you can be a guest. I don't know. Maybe we could work something out. We'll see.
Let's hear some pieces from the zines.
Dina was having a birthday party and everyone was invited. There was a cake, complete with frosted ponies and 8 pink candles, 6 flavors of name brand soda pop, a mountain of presents, and the usual assortment of party games. Pin the tail on the donkey, musical chairs, and my personal favorite, the dance contest, which I won with my funkier than funky rendition of the funky tortilla. My prize, which was supposed to be a keychain that said Disco Sucks, was a kiss from Dina's mom, Miss Joliet, 1975. Aside from that, I didn't know too much about Miss Carly, except that she was a bit of a booze jockey, drinking being an avocation that she pursued with great enthusiasm. Later, after all the presents had been opened, and all the kids and some of their parents were sitting around with plates of cake and ice cream in their laps, Miss Carly burst into the room with a martini in one hand and a mayonnaise jar filled with what looked like a squashed gopher in the other. Or maybe it was a hunk of rotten ground beef. Anyway, Dina's mom stumbled into the room and said,
"Look, everybody, it's Dina's placenta!"
She beamed with pride as she held the jar over her head like a trophy for everyone to see. Dina jumped out of her seat, dumping her cake and ice cream to the floor, where it was lapped up by her dog, Sambo. Then she let out a scream, a horrific scream, as if she was standing in the middle of the road, staring into the headlights of a bus that was about to run over her, and all she could do was cover her face and scream. Then there was silence. Everyone was quiet. Even the dog, who'd been lapping at his plate with sloppy abandon, as Dina raced across the room and made a desperate attempt to snatch the jar from her mother's hand. She kept jumping up and down, but the jar was out of reach.
"Please, Mom, please don't do this. You promised, put it away!"
Some of the kids laughed. The ones who weren't laughing were crying, including Dina, who was crying so much, I thought she might puke.
"What's wrong, Dina? It's your placenta. There's nothing to be ashamed of. God, I can't believe it's been 8 years already."
She looked at her watch.
"I would have been going to labor right about now. Jeez, the pain was incredible."
"Mom, you promised!"
"Oh, Dina, stop being so dramatic. You're going to make me spill my drink. Now, who wants to see it?"
Before anyone could respond or swallow their cake, the jar was getting passed around the room like a hot potato. No one wanted to touch it, but when it landed in my lap, I held onto it. Fascinated. I'd never seen anything like it. It was like something from Hubert's museum. I wanted to open the jar, to touch it, and maybe taste it. So I clenched the jar between my legs and attempted to unscrew the lid. But Dina screamed and grabbed the jar out of my lap. Then, like a cornered animal, a feral cat perhaps, she ran into her bedroom and slammed the door.
"That's my little girl," said Dina's mother. "All grown up. Now, who needs a drink?"
Surprisingly, there were no takers. Instead, people were getting up and stretching, glancing at their watches, and making excuses for their early departure. Dina's mom grabbed a bottle from the drink cart and said,
"I know Dina's mommy could use a little drink. Come on, who's game?"
She drained what was left of the bottle in her hand in two quick gulps. Then she got an idea.
"Hey, who wants to play spin the bottle? Let's get this party started. Come on, what do you say?"
I was standing outside of Dina's room, with my ear pressed against her door, listening to her sob into her pillow, when her mom tousled my hair and said,
"Come on, Sheldon. I know you won't let a lady drink alone. You want a drink?"
"You bet," I said. Later that night, as I lay in bed, with the room spinning pleasantly, I thought of Dina, who probably cried herself to sleep, her arms wrapped around the jar of placenta. Then I thought of her mom, her ruby red lips, the smell of her long brown hair that had just a hint of curl, her fishnet stockings and manicured nails. I thought of the heavy lids of her blue eyes, her olive-colored skin, the way she slurred her words. And then, just as I was getting to the good part, the part where we get married and people throw rice and we laugh about getting not one, but three blenders, I fell asleep.
I'm not used to having people in my house, especially loud people.
It's a nice house.
Yeah.
A few notes on getting old. You know you're getting old when you're suddenly compelled to change your clothes. And not just once in a while, but every day. Even in the winter, when it's really, really cold outside. And when you're sick and you feel like crap and you have snot hanging from your nose, and the last thing you feel like doing is getting out of bed and changing your warm, sweaty clothes. But you do it. And you know why? Because you're all grown up now. You're an old person. You swore up and down that it wouldn't happen to you, but you finally started listening to that paternal voice that nags you into submission. The voice that tells you that it's no longer acceptable to wear the same pair of socks for 3 weeks straight. Then what? Well, I'll tell you. You start thinking that maybe, just maybe, it's no longer acceptable to turn your clothes inside out in lieu of washing them. Next thing you know, you've got yourself a daily routine. You wake up every day. You eat every day. You take a shower every day. You listen to NPR and feed the cat and go to work every single day. But you have the power to stop this, to nip it in the bud and stay young. Not that I'm afraid of getting old, but you can start by refusing to change your clothes for a whole week. That includes the underwear. On second thought, make that 2 weeks. I have some friends who will disagree with this next one, but you're also getting old when one of the things you just can't live without is a garlic press. Don't get me wrong, I'm not hating on garlic. I love garlic. I add it to every meal. Peanut butter and jelly, oatmeal, you name it. And I'm not averse to eating it raw, like an apple. But I assure you, I will never sign to a major label, and I will never own a garlic press. And yet, I'll admit that I sometimes find myself standing in one of those hideous stores that sells nothing but garlic presses, shower curtains, oven mitts, and a bunch of other status symbols cleverly disguised as innocuous household contrivances. And as I stand there, surrounded by all those shiny housewares, I actually start to contemplate my life with a garlic press. I pick one up, and immediately I can feel its power coursing through my veins. I can see myself very clearly as I chop hundreds, no thousands of cloves of garlic in just seconds flat. It seems so fun, so easy, so well worth the $8 price tag. But then, as I'm about to hand over my money, I come to my senses and shout, "No!
No! 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 No!
I can't be bought. And I storm out of the store with my head held high, knowing that I managed to resist temptation. I mean, does everything have to be made easy? Have I gotten so old that I can't even chop my own garlic? Does it really make it taste better? Today it's a garlic press. Tomorrow it's the clapper and remote control everything. So if you own a garlic press, I want you to march into the kitchen, take it out of the drawer where you keep the T-ball and your egg timer that's shaped like a chicken, and throw it out the window. Trust me, you'll feel better, and you'll be adding years to your life. And finally, you know you're getting old when you get to the airport 2 hours early. You didn't forget anything, and you're completely sober. Instead of going out with your friends who wanted to wish you a farewell, you stayed in and packed your clothes, and for once they were all clean. You didn't miss your flight because you had to be physically removed from the airport bar when they refused to serve you at 9 in the morning. There was no fighting, no puking, no nothing. Everything was as it should be. Normal. Smooth. Uneventful. Damn, I'm getting old. I suffer from the kind of social anxiety that borders on agoraphobia. I've always been extremely shy, but this is more than just shyness. This is far more debilitating, but I'm trying to work through it by forcing myself to go out in public and do things that normal people do, like go to a cafe and order a cup of coffee. Yesterday, I went to this place called the Tea Lounge. It's your typical coffee house with couches and chessboards and hippies and yuppies and people with their laptops. Exactly the kind of place I try to avoid. Anyway, it took me about 50 minutes to walk there. And then, when I got to the door, I stopped and contemplated whether or not I should actually go in.
Do I really want to go out there? I mean, can I just leave my book at home? I hate my single-party cars and cafes. Do you want to be that guy? I'm so much fun to talk to. What would I say? I always think that the dumbest thing.
But then, coming up the street, I saw someone coming towards me, someone I worked with. I needed a place to hide, so I ducked into the cafe, and of course, everybody stared at me. Why are they staring at me? Somehow I managed to make my way to the counter, where a girl with dreadlocks, smelling like patchouli, took my order. And I managed to say, I'll have a large cafe au lait, without stammering or knocking anything over. I got a seat in the window, opened my Raymond Chandler book, and what's this? It's John Mellencamp blasting over the stereo. I can't believe my ears. You see, this is why I don't go out. It's little things like this that makes going out so unbearable.
Little did about Jack and Diane. Jack and Bracken keep going out in the heartland.
Thank you. people. I'll be with you in a moment.
I started my first band when I was in the second grade. I was the drummer, the backbone, and my brother, Ira, played the guitar. My drum kit consisted of pots and pans, empty boxes,
shoe boxes work best,
coffee cans, pie tins, telephone books, pillows, and sofa cushions. Altogether, I had about 75 to 100 pieces, and when I set them up, they filled two rooms. The only thing missing was a flaming gong, for which I was diligently saving my allowance. According to my calculations, that would have taken something like 20 years. Well, I couldn't wait that long, so when Christmas rolled around, there was only one thing on my list. Flaming Gong, written with red crayon in a wavy flame-like script. I even wrote several letters to Santa, begging him to please send me a flaming gong. I didn't believe in Santa, of course, but I figured that my parents, impressed by my determination, would break down and get me the flaming gong I so badly wanted. Needed. But when Christmas morning finally rolled around, there was no gong, just tube socks. I got 10 pairs of tube socks and a candy cane. Don't get me wrong, I love socks, but they're no substitute for a flaming gong. Anyway, Ira's guitar was a tennis racket, and not a very nice one either. Though sometimes, if the song called for it, he would switch to a racquetball racket. You know, for that sound that only a racquetball racket can produce. Kind of like when that guy in R.E.M. used the mandolin. The rest of the band was rounded out with stuffed animals. A gorilla, two bears, and an aardvark, who I referred to as the Grubtones. They were responsible for backup vocals, hand claps, and some light percussion. And they were good, but I had to let them go when we needed more people for the audience. They turned out to be better audience members than band members anyways. One of the hardest things about starting a band is picking the right name. Dead Kennedys, The Sonics, Devo, The Psychos, The Goblins, Blue Oyster Cult, X, Fugazi. These are all great names that are absolutely perfect for the music and bands they represent. They exemplify their sound to a T. They are perfect in every way, and that's what we strive for. So after many hours of heated debate, me and Ira decided to call ourselves the Booger Boys. At first, it was just the Boogers. Then we changed it to Snots. We kicked around a few other ideas. Let's see, there was the Penguins, the Pizzas, the Flashlights, the Darts, the Sharks, the Wieners, the Butts, and I Hate School. What do you expect? We were kids. But we finally settled on the Booger Boys because one, we were boys, two, we thought it was funny, and three, me and Ira had one of the best booger walls in town. We were the envy of all our friends. I'm not sure how it started or why we did it, but we both had the habit of picking our noses as we lay in bed and wiping the little and not so little gems on the wall. Over time, the wall became so encrusted with snot that it looked like a climbing wall. All you needed was a rope and up you go. And since we slept in bunk beds, I was on the bottom bunk, I took to wiping my boogers onto my brother's bed. After a while, it started to look like I was sleeping in a cave with sharp stalactites hanging from the ceiling. When our parents found out about what we were doing, they started duct taping oven mitts over our hands before we went to sleep, and pretty soon, the booger wall was no more. Anyway, our early set consisted of three cover songs. The Monster Mash, we wore plastic fangs and green makeup for that number, which lasted about 15 to 20 minutes. Pac-Man Fever, and Satisfaction. And we were pretty good. We were better than good. We rocked. I could tell right off the bat that we were going to be huge. That we would undoubtedly go on to play sold-out shows at Leeds, Soldier's Field, Madison Square Garden, Altamont, and Budokan to millions, no billions of screaming fans. And we would have an endless array of merchandise. T-shirts, posters, action figures, lunchboxes, trading cards, coffee mugs, shaving kits, mouse pads, nightlights, shower curtains, and paint-by-number sets. But then, and isn't this always the case? Just as things were starting to get good, and were really starting to cook, the band broke up. Ira was the first to quit, citing creative differences as his reason for leaving. In other words, he got a better gig with a bunch of sixth graders who were going to lip-sync to a bunch of crappy Beatles songs at the school talent show. I couldn't believe that Ira left the band. I was devastated. I mean, who the hell did he think he was? Dave Davies? No, he was Ira Grubbs Jr. and he played the tennis racket. And rather poorly, I might add. Who was he to walk out on me, his own brother? I should have walked out on him. And for what? So he could go lip-sync like a monkey to a bunch of Beatles songs? Okay, if it was the Stones, then I could understand. I could forgive him, but I wouldn't understand. But the Beatles? Incredible. Anyway, I knew that if I was ever going to recover from this little setback, that I was going to have to collect myself, stay focused, and start a new band. That was my plan. But first, I would lock myself in my room and put on all my clothes at the same time. If you've never done this before, you should definitely try it. It always makes me feel a lot better. After an hour or so of begging, my mother forced Ira to take me to one of the rehearsals, which usually took place in someone's basement or garage. I just had to see what it was all about, to see what was so great that Ira had to ditch the Booger Boys. So we went to Frank's house, where the rest of the band was waiting for my brother. Frank's mom pinched my cheeks, because I have the kind of cheeks that mothers love to pinch, and showed us to the basement, where the rest of the band was laughing and engaging in various forms of tomfoolery. But when they saw me walking down the stairs, it suddenly became very silent. Then,
"Hey, what's he doing here? This is a closed session, man."
Rushing to my defense, Ira said,
"I had to bring him. He kept running into the wall and falling on the ground, and he wouldn't stop, so my mom made me bring him. Don't worry, he just wants to watch."
So I was shoved into a chair and told to shut up and be quiet while they got into position and cued the tape. Two of the guys, John and Paul, I assumed, were holding pool sticks, and Ira, George, was standing to the side with his tennis racket. And the last guy, Ringo, was sitting on a stool behind a cheap toy drum kit that was made of clear plastic. I bit my lip and thought, God, if I could just get my hands on some of those sweet, sweet drums. The drummer's name was Chuck Kowalski. His little sister, Jennifer, was in my class. She had freckles and pigtails, and she smelled like butter. But of course, people like her get to go on to the fourth grade, while people like me, people with a vision, are forced to stay behind. If only social promotion had existed 20 years ago, then maybe I wouldn't have spent most of my life feeling like such a retard. But you know what? I'm over it. Sort of. Anyway, the music started, and the band went into their act. Their mouths were moving, but none of them seemed to be saying the same thing. And they moved like those robots at the Hall of Presidents at Disneyland. Real stiff. Okay, that I could take. But what I couldn't take was the fact that they were dead serious. And by the time they were done with the first song, I was on the floor laughing. I laughed so hard that I nearly choked on my own vomit. How ironic would that have been? Anyway, I was on the ground, thrashing about and laughing my ass off when John and Paul dropped their instruments and stormed off the stage, which only made me laugh that much harder. God, they sucked even more than the Strokes and the White Stripes combined. John and Paul were pouting in the corner and refused to resume practice until I left the room. So I was dragged upstairs and locked in a room with Frank's older sister, Beth. She was in eighth grade. The walls of her bedroom were covered with pictures of horses and teen idols. Not the band, but actual teen idols like Ricky Schroeder, Ralph Macchio, and Sal Mineo. She got up and sat down on her bed. Then she cleaned her glasses on the blouse of her school uniform and said,
"Come here and have a seat."
God, she was so nice. Curly hair, dimples, scabs on her knees. So I went down and sat next to her.
"Why aren't you downstairs playing with the boys?"
She had a piece of spinach stuck between her teeth. "Closed session," I said.
"Oh, well, you can stay here and play if you want. I have some dolls and some books. How about Scrabble? Do you like Scrabble?"
"Beth, can I ask you something?"
"Sure, Sheldon, what is it?"
"Well, it's something I heard. Something that Ira told me. About you." When I mentioned Ira, her ears pricked up. She had a thing for him. I'm surprised she didn't have a picture of him hanging on her wall.
"What is it, Sheldon? Tell me, tell me, tell me, what is it?"
She was bouncing up and down her bed. When she finally settled down, I said,
"I'm meteorologist Bob Larson."
People are
getting excited
over the new
Hollywood blockbuster.
Why am I a jerk because I'd rather see Fog of War instead of giving my hard-earned money to corporate fat cats who are more interested in selling action figures and soft drinks and cheap, insipid emotions than they are about making a decent movie? Like most business people, they will sell anything the public is willing to buy. Deodorant, quarter pounders, Adam Sandler movies, you name it. If they thought they could make money selling chocolate-covered razor blades to children, they would. This is Sheldon Grubbs saying, reject mainstream media, consume with a conscience, support self-publishing, smash the states, and leave your cell phone at home, and curb your dog. Thank you. Your pal, Sheldon Grubbs. Thank you for listening.
This has been the EdShep Radio Experiment. Thank you for listening and tune in next week. This is EdShep signing off.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, and WFMU.org.